This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 86 was recorded on December 23rd, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by the generosity of our listeners whose donations make this show possible. Joining us this Christmas holiday is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman. Luke, happy holidays. What's got your attention recently?
Yeah, hey, happy holidays, Eric. Thanks for having me on. You know, what's caught our attention recently is that, to my eyes, it appears the Fed has engaged in its own version of, or its own whatever it takes moment. But most investors either don't realize it or don't seem to believe it yet.
What do you mean, Luke? Because it seems to me like, if anything, they're trying to qualify. They're doing QE, but they're insisting we can't call it QE.
It's a great point. You know, what I mean is so last time we talked was on November 11th, I think it was, in my notes. And back then, as I look at my notes, we said the following. The one thing that has really grabbed me recently is I can't find anyone willing to say we don't have one more risk off before what so many have called the quote end game occurs, which is the Fed monetizing U.S. deficits on an open-ended basis. This fascinates me. I mean, here we have the Fed, quote, accidentally monetizing the U.S. Treasury in slow motion, which is what one strategist at the time called it. They undid 10 months of QT in just 9 weeks in response to what was a very brief but very serious crisis in repo markets. And yet, as far as I can tell, overwhelming consensus, I mean, nearly unanimous consensus, is that we need at least one more risk-off crisis before the Fed goes to open-ended monetization of deficits. And all of which made us think here that, you know, in my 25 years in the business, every time I've seen a situation where everyone's waiting for an event to be their trigger to jump in, the trigger never comes and everyone's forced to chase. And so, you know, back then we concluded by saying that it's almost unanimous that we need another crisis before the Fed moves to what some have called the end game. But let me ask you this, what if the repo rate spike was the crisis? Because we said if that's the case, most market participants are probably still offsides in terms of positioning, even with the big move up in the S&P 500 versus the TLT or the long bond over the past 4 weeks.
Well, I think clearly the collector's item T-shirt is going to be, I remember quantitative tightening. That's a rarity. So let's fast forward 6 weeks to now, because we've had what some people are calling a melt-up in equities. So what are your updated thoughts? It sounds like this is kind of what you were predicting.
So, you know, it's increasingly looking to me as if the repo rate spike was indeed the crisis that everyone was waiting for to occur into year end. And, you know, many investors were waiting for another 4Q18-like sell-off as the year-end liquidity drained from regulatory-related dynamics sort of bit, and rightfully so. But what those expecting a 4Q18-like sell-off missed, in our view, was that the Fed's response to the September repo rate spike was the Fed's own whatever-it-takes moment, basically, you know, channeling Draghi and the ECB back in 2012.
Why do you think that this happened? I mean, you know, in the past, it took something going wrong that was usually an equity market event as opposed to what a lot of people thought was just a blip in the repo market. So why do you think that those investors that thought that it was going to take a big risk-off event to bring this about missed the call?
It's hard, right? This business is such a humbling business. So I think their analysis of the regulatory side and what that would do to dollar liquidity, and then the dollar liquidity drain side as a result of U.S. deficits, I think that was dead on. In the absence of the Fed, the dollar should have spiked massively. We should have had an epic risk off, maybe even bigger than what we had last year in the fourth quarter. But in our view, the key in what I just said, as it's turning out, is that in the absence of the Fed, you know, what those investors looking for the dollar liquidity drain in 4Q19 to drive a major risk off and a dollar spike missed was that, you know, as we sort of suspected, the repo rate spike amounted to this whatever it takes moment for the Fed. And what that meant as a practical matter was the Fed was cornered into supplying whatever liquidity was needed to keep markets from selling off in the fourth quarter.
But why do you think that the Fed did that? Because in the past, they've at least told us, supposedly, they're not in the business of bailing out markets and, you know, they only support the economy and so forth. So to react the way they did to the repo market event with what really was a new round of QE, even if they don't want to call it that, why not just let free markets work and do their job?
It's a great question. It's the right question. And the answer, you know, it's going to sound flip, but it's not flip. The answer is real politic or political economics. You know, real politic or political economics meant there was no way the Fed could simply let markets work. There's just not a chance.
What do you mean? Why is there not a chance? A lot of their messaging, you know, weeks, months before this was saying, hey, we're not in the business of bailing out the stock market. You know, Jay Powell, when he took office, went out of his way to really sell that point. Don't you guys expect me to be in the business of bailing out markets? It's not what we do at the Fed. Well, kind of looks like that is what they do at the Fed.
Yeah. And the reason it was different this time, it's, you know, it's not really different this time in the long lens of history, but it's different for, you know, people focused strictly on U.S. markets going back 50 to 100 years, is it's because of several things we've been saying for some time, which is that there's nobody more short dollars sooner than the U.S. government. If you look back, the U.S. government's gross treasury issuance in fiscal 2019 ended up being at $11.5 trillion. And 71% of that $11.5 trillion was issued at 6 months or less. And so what you have is the U.S. government effectively funding itself in short-term funding markets. So if the Fed just let markets work like Powell said he wanted to do, repo would go back to 10% or more, and the U.S. government would need to roll $6 trillion or so in the next 6 months at 10% plus. And the U.S. government cannot afford to roll $6 trillion at 10% plus, especially since at 10% plus, the highly financialized U.S. economy would collapse. So the financing needs would non-linearly go from $6 trillion to $8 trillion to $10 trillion over the next 6 months as tax receipts collapsed. And, you know, mortgages would be at 12% plus, so you'd have housing collapsing. Banking system would likely quickly follow. Corporate debt issuance would grind to a halt with repo at 10%. They can't afford to roll any of that stuff at 10% plus. So record U.S. corporate debt issuance would begin defaulting, which with corporate leverage as high as it is, could easily quickly wipe out, you know, significant portions, if not the majority, of the equity market cap of the United States and the world. And, you know, remember, as we've noted multiple times, in the U.S., equity market cap's 160% of GDP, and net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions alone are around 200% of annual growth in personal consumption expenditures, which itself is two-thirds of GDP. So, you know, in plain English, there's no economy in the U.S. or the world if U.S. stocks crashed. And that's not hyperbole. That's just sixth grade math. So all of this suggests that back in September, when repo rates spiked, the Fed faced a choice: let the global economy collapse and the U.S. government nominally default on entitlements, treasuries, and or defense spending, you know, because tax receipts would collapse while interest expense rose by 5x from 2% to 10% plus, or do whatever it takes to contain overnight funding markets. And the Fed chose the latter, which in my opinion was the right choice. But, you know, as you note, that choice has implications.
Do you think that investors have figured this all out and realized this yet? And what are the implications of this, if you're right?
Some investors, yeah, they have. But I don't think there's that many yet. I think most don't realize yet what, you know, what we've referred to, you know, earlier this year with you, Eric, as Voldemort, is what's driving all of this. I mean, Voldemort is simply a U.S. balance of payments crisis. And it's sort of, you know, looks different because it's the U.S. than what you might see in other balance of payments crises. But U.S. government needs to roll $6 trillion in the next 6 months, and they probably need to roll $6 to $7 trillion in the ensuing 6 months. And then, you know, rinse, wash, rinse, repeat. And since the foreign private sector is not buying enough treasuries because the dollar's too strong, there's not enough domestic private sector liquidity to fund those auctions without crashing pretty much everything else in the economy, unless the Fed helps fund those deficits. So, you know, I'd suspect that within 6 months, a quorum of investors may come around to our view of things, that, you know, the repo rate spike basically was the Fed's own whatever it takes moment. You know, as far as the implications, if we're right that the repo rate spike already was the crisis, that it was the Fed's whatever it takes moment, the overriding takeaway to us is that, know, the Fed's balance sheet will likely not be able to stop expanding until one or more of the, of four things happens. And those four things are, number one, Basel III ceases to remain in effect for U.S. banks. Two is foreign central banks begin growing treasury holdings fast enough again. Three is U.S. federal spending on entitlements, defense, or interest expense shrinks significantly. Or four, the dollar falls significantly to make FX hedge treasury yields non-negative again for the foreign private sector so that they can start buying treasuries en masse as they once were. And so you look at each of these four, I don't think Basel III is going to be cut for U.S. banks. I mean, but that could conceivably happen, I suppose. Foreign central banks, they're likely not going to begin growing treasury holdings fast enough again until FX hedge treasury yields are positive. And even if there were no geopolitical reasons for some central banks to not buy them, right, I don't think China is going to be coming back into the business of buying, you know, $100 billion in treasuries or more every year like they were a decade ago. There simply aren't enough current account surpluses abroad to buy treasuries in FX reserves with the dollar as strong as it is. No one's generating the surpluses to recycle them into treasuries. So the U.S. government, you know, you go to the third point, is the U.S. government going to cut spending on any of these things in an election year? Probably not. And so that leaves the dollar. It must be the release valve. And so as investors begin to realize that the Fed's balance sheet likely can't stop growing until the dollar falls, likely by a lot, I think that'll be the trigger. So as a quorum of investors begin to realize this, my bet is the first thing that will happen is the bond market will begin to realize that it's offsides big time. And you know, you'll start to see rates begin to back up globally. And I think we're probably in the early days of this with what we've seen with rates. At first, I think that'd probably be good for equities as bond money flows into equities, you know, on sort of a non-crisis relief rally, and then maybe as an inflation hedge. Initially, you know, I think this could weigh on gold a bit. And I think we've seen that effect on gold already to a large extent. But after you get sort of that initial sell-off in gold, I think over the next 6 to 12 months, I really strongly suspect that gold should begin to surge as investors begin to realize that, you know, what it looks like a rise in nominal rates is actually a drop in real rates, because they're going to start to realize the Fed's balance sheet likely can't stop growing until FX hedge treasury yields are positive again, which requires the dollar to fall pretty sharply.
Luke, how long do you think we have until a quorum of investors begins to realize this? And what will you be looking for to know if you're wrong?
I think we're at most 3 to 6 months from a quorum of investors realizing how cornered the Fed is, Eric. You know, as far as what I'll be looking for to know I'm wrong, you know, I'll be watching with great interest to see what happens to the Fed's balance sheet and the repo programs, the whole slew of non-QE, as well as the regulatory equivalents and what happens to those in the first quarter of this year. And what I mean by that is that I think the Fed's balance sheet will likely continue to grow after the year-end turn, which to me will be a sign the issue's far more structural than the mainstream narrative. And if it does not continue growing, then I'll be watching for regulatory forbearance that would amount to the same thing. So if U.S. banks suddenly get breaks from Basel regulations or a standing repo facility is announced, then it's possible you could see the Fed run, you know, what's effectively a sleight of hand where they shrink the balance sheet, but they change regulations, so the amount of dollar liquidity continues to rise. So that's, I'll be watching to see if that happens. However, if the Fed doesn't continue to supply whatever it takes type of liquidity until the dollar falls in one form or another, the only winners would likely be the dollar, gold, and treasuries. You know, you'd start to see repo rates spike back up, you know, perhaps as high as they were at the highs if the Fed didn't do enough, and they'd stay there until either the Fed expanded the balance sheet in whatever it takes fashion or until the world and U.S. economies collapsed. And given that the U.S. government's financing 71% of its annual gross funding needs of $11 to $12 trillion at 6 months or less, you know, that collapse would likely quickly result in a U.S. nominal default on entitlements, treasuries, or defense, which is something that is not different this time in the grand scope of history, but it is very different this time relative to the last 50, 60 years in the U.S. So, you know, given the stakes as high as they are, our bet is that the Fed's likely just keep doing whatever it takes. And if we're right, I think most investors are likely underestimating where the Fed's balance sheet could end up in 2020.
Okay, so given that, I've got to believe that you still favor precious metals, equities, basically all the things that benefit from reflation when the Fed is printing money. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, we really like gold and silver, still like Bitcoin, although it's not done anything recently. We still favor equities against bonds, but especially those emerging markets. And that have strong balance of payments and strong FX reserve and gold reserve positions. So, you know, Russia did really well this year. I think that that would continue in this type of environment. Parts of Asia. Also think that the EU could actually be a net winner if the Fed's new whatever it takes position continues. And then within the U.S., I think industrials and cyclicals, commodity-related names, would probably do quite well. And of course, that leads us to still be bearish on the dollar.
Luke, I want to take this conversation one step farther, which is we've been talking about this, let's call it the whatever it takes regime. You've been referring to that as the end game in this discussion, but I think it's a matter of time frames. If I really think about, to my thinking, what is the real end game, it's not that, because let's suppose you're right about everything you've said today, and what happens is we see the Fed expanding their balance sheet. Initially, it's this sort of whatever it takes to deal with the repo crisis, but it grows into outright monetization of U.S. deficit spending because, as you say, there's really not a lot of other choices. I won't be surprised if eventually it expands even more, and so that it's not just expanding the balance sheet for those things, but it's also expanding the balance sheet for helicopter money, for, you know, providing universal basic income and free college and free healthcare and who knows whatever else. I could see a lot of these things going. And frankly, those things, I think, could probably go on for a fairly long time. As you say, the dollar might be the victim in that scenario, which means that gold would do very well. But, you know, relative value of the dollar going down relative to other currencies would be a good thing for the world. So it's not really an end game in my mind. I'm thinking the end game is someday, and it doesn't seem to be someday soon, but someday you get runaway inflation. And at that point, they can't just expand the balance sheet because it only exacerbates the problem. And that's where you get a really scary end game. Am I right logically to think that's the gating factor we have to be most worried about someday? Or am I putting too much of a cart before the horse there?
No, I think that there's a real risk of that. To me, I think we'll start to get some of that inflation. I wouldn't say call it runaway inflation, but I think we're going to get, you know, I think you need to break it down to, when we define inflation, reported inflation and actual inflation. I think actual inflation has been higher than it's been reported. I don't think I'm very unique in saying that. I think actual inflation is probably going to accelerate pretty meaningfully in 2020 and 2021. I'm not convinced that reported inflation will keep pace. And so where I think we're going to go is some version of, you know, creeping, you know, so you get an acceleration inflation. Say we can see actual inflation at 5 to 10% and reported inflation at 2 to 3%. And then, you know, for a while, you know, that buys you time, right? The bond market just listens to what the government says, and that's fine. And at some point, it may start to show up in wages or elsewhere, and you'll see the bond market back up. And that's something that's sort of unique about this cycle for the U.S., at least. This is something every other country on the world has dealt with for years and years and years. But that's to say, because foreign central banks are no longer sterilizing our deficits on net, they're no longer growing their holdings of treasuries, the Fed, this is the first cycle in 50 to 70 years where if the economy slows too much, the Fed's going to have to grow their balance sheet. And if inflation takes off too much, the Fed's going to have to grow their balance sheet. They'll cap yields. This is the first time we've been in this situation since World War II. And, you know, Bernanke in 2002, in his famous deflation speech, he told everybody what's going to happen. They capped the short term at 3/8, and they capped the middle of the curve at 7/8, and they capped the 10-year at 2.5%. And the balance sheet grew if it needed to. And you basically had what was a Frankenstein yield curve, which was, hey, 3/8 to 2.5. You know, there's a spread there. You can make money. And inflation, you know, ran at a surplus to all of that. And, you know, for those 9 years, like, you got paid as a treasury holder. You know, you certainly didn't lose any money nominally. But, you know, the S&P rose 5x and inflation got a little crazy during that period of time. But to me, I think that's sort of the scenario for the next 2-3 years at least. And, you know, at some point, I would think that you would get into, as the market begins to figure this out, the, you know, the bond market begins to figure out that it is that it is being taken advantage of, I think you'll see capital controls of some description, where suddenly that money's not allowed to move around as much. And, you know, basically, somebody's got to lose. And the government needs its money. The government's not going to lose. The government's not going to shrink. And so then it comes down to risk assets or bondholders. And bondholders can't get paid if risk assets fall because of how we structured our economy. And so risk assets have to run, which means bondholders have to lose on a real basis. So I just think that's where, you know, I think in terms of a catastrophic, you know, Weimar or currency really destroying inflation, I think that's, I mean, I guess it's always possible, but I don't think it's very likely. And at any rate, I don't think anytime soon.
Well, let's close on that positive note, Luke. And I can't thank you enough for both today's interview and for all of the terrific content that you have contributed to Macro Voices in the last year. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by the generosity of our listeners. If you're enjoying Macro Voices and enjoyed it in 2019, we hope you'll consider making a donation this holiday season using the green donate button on our homepage at macrovoices.com. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.